What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Ow!
Those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof, ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy rinse-free whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for 2 shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White, a whiter smile without the rinse.
It's Wednesday, March 6th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And yesterday we were talking about the announced retirement of Senator Kyrsten Sinema. You know, I like Kyrsten Sinema. It's a weird thing. Don't really like all her politics, question her tactics. I'd have voted with the other 49 or 50 senators when it came to full funding for things like the infrastructure package and the prescription drug price cuts. I just, for some reason, I know people like that, like women who dress a little crazy and run triathlons and look to Democrats and say, oh my God, what's with these people? I like them. I think we'd be friends. You know who I don't think I'd be friends with? And this pains me to say, I don't think Theodore Roosevelt would like me. I don't know if you've ever heard me say this, but I think friendship is 85% who likes you. Just for some reason, I like the cut of Kyrsten Sinema's jib, to say nothing of her flouncy yellow dress she wore at the last State of the Union. So I was thinking about all this, or not really, it was perhaps somewhere in the back of my mind, when I came across on Twitter a post by Senator Chris Murphy, who I also like. I don't know if we'd be pals, like me and the imagined Kyrsten Sinema hangout. But Murphy tweeted in a tweet thread, there are lots of strong feelings about Senator Sinema on this platform, and I'm not going to change anyone's mind. But because she rarely talks to the press, few people know what she does behind the scenes. One, I didn't get anyone's permission to tell this story, but I'm going to do it anyway. That, by the way, that's a key. If you want people to listen to your threads, say that you didn't get anyone's permission, no matter what it is. I didn't get anyone's permission to say this, but add an avocado for lunch. Here Murphy goes on. Kristen and I, he calls her Kristen instead of Kyrsten throughout, let's call it kind of enduring. Kristen and I, he says, meeting Kyrsten, and by the way, it's not his fault. That's a just hard name to track. Kyrsten and I were two of the four negotiators on the 2022 gun bill. Her priority was ending the boyfriend loophole, which allowed domestic abusers to keep their guns if they weren't married to the victim. The loophole was a death sentence for thousands of women. I think that's overstated. That's fine. A nitpick, an abomination. I agree with that. Republicans stubbornly resisted every attempt we made to close the loophole. I was worried the clock was ticking and we'd lose our shot, in infelicitous phrase, to get any gun bill. By the way, if you're working on guns, there are so many metaphors that are gun related, it's hard to duck them, right? You know, it's hard to just stay out of the range of fire. And when you do, you catch some flack. Put a target on your back. Anyway, he was talking about 3 weeks into the talks, I told Kyrsten that if we couldn't get agreement at the next meeting, we had to move on. Kyrsten's job out of college, first job out of college, was at a domestic violence shelter worker. She knew these women's stories. She knew the fatal cost of leaving the loophole in place. At the meeting, we made no new progress. I started to suggest moving on, and then I caught Kyrsten's eyes. I could read her eyes. Don't do it, Chris. So I stopped mid-thought. I dropped it. And after the meeting wrapped, she said to me, I know we're almost out of time. Just give me 48 more hours. I know I could get this done. I need to get this done. And she did it. Quietly, she worked out a new compromise. She and I got domestic violence advocates on board, and she just refused to take no from an answer from our Republican partners. Don't know if that's always a valid negotiating policy, but as Murphy tells it, it is. And plausibly, the final bill included a provision closing almost all the loophole. Listen, Kyrsten is way more conservative than me. We disagree on lots. You could think what you want of her. But this story isn't an outlier. Time after time, big, important, progressive things have happened because behind the scenes, Kyrsten, now it's Kyrsten, wills them to happen. That's the truth. And of course, people on Twitter said, you've changed my mind. You were wrong. This was the thing. No, they excoriated him with, I still don't like her. But why did he say this? I wanted to back up. Why would he say this? Well, it burnishes his own reputation as a earned reputation as one of the leading gun control advocates in the Senate. But I don't think it's because he wanted to associate himself with Kyrsten Sinema for any political reason. And I was thinking of a post also posted yesterday by John Fetterman, where he just came to the defense of Lauren Boebert, who's been, you know, who's a fool and has been cruel to him, but her family, her son was arrested. And Fetterman tweeted, "This is a family in crisis, and the recreational cruelty I see on social media needs to be out of bounds. I know the impact this has on children. I'm calling for restraint because cruelty is substantial collateral damage. We can't ever forget that they didn't sign up for this." And people said, "Again, you've changed my mind. While I don't like Lauren Boebert, you are the leading voice of reason on this, and I have come around to your call for kindness." No, they didn't say that. They said, "Boebert is a tramp. She gets what she deserves. And he was 18 and an adult, and she shouldn't be a grandmother at 36 and all those horrible things." Actually, some people did say nice things to him, and I started following those people. I said to myself, maybe I'll get a better Twitter following, people who like John Fetterman's kindness on Twitter. But then I found out a lot of those people had MAGA in their bios, and I said, I don't know how much this is working out. But here's my thought, uniting what Fetterman said and what Murphy said. I do think these elected officials, some of whom are really good at social media, are really good at Twitter. John Fetterman, who probably would not be in the U.S. Senate if it weren't for Twitter and his skill at it, they recognize that it's really ugly out there. That's not profound. But they recognize that forces that even when and if they control and shape them, when they can steer the lightning, help them in their political and professional quests, these forces are so caustic, I already said ugly, that it is better in general to contain them. AOC, I saw getting harassed leaving at a Brooklyn movie theater, one I've been to, as she goes down the escalator past the Target. Like, ooh, AOC using escalators just like us. And some Israeli protester is screaming at her, "Say genocide, say genocide." And her, I think, boyfriend, fiance says, "Just leave her alone." And she even tries a little bit to reason with these people who can't be reasoned with. By the way, every protester now wearing a mask. Are they all worried about COVID, or do they not want to be identified? And we've given a socially sanctioned way for that to happen. But all of these people, and I'm not even talking about people in the Senate who are very powerful and look at Twitter a little askance and are a little nervous about it. I'm talking about Fetterman and AOC, they know that the mood in America and the temperature needs to come down. And if they illustrate this point by even saying some kind things, some eye-opening things about the people who are most hated by the other side on social media, I actually think that proves the point. And that shows just how far we've come and just how much they know we're in a dangerous place. So I have different opinions of the four elected officials that I have discussed. But on the issue of what they are discussing, which I think broadly can be described as lowering the temperature, I couldn't be more committed to that. On the show today, I'll bring Chris Murphy back for a callback as I discuss the role of the uncommitted vote on Super Tuesday. But first, Rob Henderson. Oh, he's a public intellectual, and he's earned his stripes on Substack. He was a child who was abandoned or neglected to the extent that he wound up in the California foster care system. He joined the Air Force out of high school. He eventually is identified as having such intellectual heft that he was nurtured and he finds his way to Yale University. His Substack is called Rob Henderson's Newsletter. It belies the interesting thoughts therein, the title does. And now he's out with a new book about his life, Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class. We'll talk about his upbringing and his interactions from the lowest social classes to the elite and what he's learned. Rob Henderson up next. Winter, where I'm from, is not over. But I look at the bright side. I call it soup season. And I try to get all the ingredients, source the ingredients, master my recipe. And as I'm doing that, getting cash back on the purchases I make, with Ibotta. Ibotta is the free app that gives you the most cash back every time you shop on hundreds of items, from groceries, spices, and stock, to beauty supplies, to toys. You beat inflation no matter what you're purchasing. Your average Ibotta user earns $145 a year. Don't you want $145 a year? You know what it costs you? It costs you nothing to use the app, Ibotta. Get in on that. Other apps give you points that don't amount to much. With Ibotta, you just add your offers in the app, you upload your receipt, and then you get real cash that you can cash out to your bank account or PayPal or gift cards. Join the over 50 million savers and earn cash back every time you shop from over 2,700 brands and retailers, including Lowe's, Macy's, Sephora, Best Buy, and more. Right now, Ibotta is offering our listeners $5, wow, just for trying Ibotta, by using the code THEGIST when you register. This is free money upon free money. Go to the App Store or Google Play, download the free Ibotta app to start earning cash back, and use the code THEGIST, that's Ibotta, in the Google Play or App Store, and use the code THEGIST. It will help you, it will help the show, and the soup you might make can help you, you know, clear up those block sinuses. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Rob Henderson is I shall call him a public intellectual. His new book, a memoir, is really good. And I think it's going to hit the intended audience, which are really smart people like him who get a book pressed into their hands by maybe a mentor figure who say, read this book. Maybe you'll see something to identify with. Because, you know, that exact process helped Rob throughout his life, helped him join the military, go to Yale, and Beyond the Gist, the subtitle of Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class. And we should note, and I think this is instructive, on the back cover, you know, where they talk about one's credits. He graduated from Yale. He had a Gates Cambridge scholarship. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, and the New York Post, among other outlets. And I think most writers would not submit to the New York Post, would not brag about being in the New York Post. But that tells you a little bit about who Rob is trying to reach. Welcome to The Gist, Rob.
Hey, Mike. Thank you. It's great to be here. And you know, it's funny. There was a really interesting study from Pew, I think it was last year, that found that when they analyzed these researchers, I think they analyzed the content of the New York Post and found that the sort of the outlook of the New York Post was the most representative of the typical sort of median American voter. And so I think it's interesting, right, that the average voter kind of, their views are more or less reflected in the Post, but among like the sort of the intelligentsia, the media class, we're kind of like, oh, I don't know about the New York Post. They're not maybe in the same category as some of these others, but I like the Post.
No, I don't think they say, I don't know about the New York Post. I think they say, I don't like the New York Post publicly, and then privately have a subscription. In fact, this might be 12 years old, but the two most common subscriptions, concomitant subscriptions, were not the Times and the Journal or the Daily News and the Times, which are aligned editorially. It's the Post and the Times. Those are the ones that go together, and the Post was definitely the guilty pleasure. And that gets a lot at, I mean, we could start with biography, but let's start with your outlook and your claims to fame. That gets right at a lot of what you study, which is the disconnect, hypocrisy, if you want to call it, between elite attitudes for other people and themselves. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell me about when you started to notice this?
Yeah, well, I arrived at Yale at a very interesting time. I was, you know, what they call a non-traditional student or a mature student. I arrived on campus during kind of the early days, or, you know, maybe even the birth of what people now call wokeness, although that term hadn't quite caught on in 2015. But I was 25 years old when I started college, so a little later than a lot of my peers there. I had just gotten out of the Air Force. Served 8 years in the military before that. I lived in foster homes and in just sort of all sorts of kind of, you know, marginal working class, kind of near poverty conditions in Los Angeles and all around California. So I get to Yale. And of course, I got there understanding that, you know, it's kind of a famous university. I knew a lot of the students there would come from rich families, but I didn't quite have a sense yet for the sort of cultural disconnect, the social disconnect, the opinions that these students would have, and how at odds they were with conventional kind of typical American views. And so I would hear these bizarre opinions around family, around, you know, attitudes around college, around, you know, these newfangled ideas about how to help the poor. And then, you know, I would compare them with views that I'd heard when I was enlisted or when I was growing up in working class parts of California, and then realize that, oh, these beliefs, I mean, they could only have arisen, you know, what I called them luxury beliefs. I coined this term luxury beliefs and developed a whole sort of sociological framework around it, sort of developed out of old school theories around sociology and economics and more recent empirical research in social psychology. I did a PhD in psychology. And so, you know, I drew on a lot of my academic expertise, but a lot of my personal experiences as well. And these luxury beliefs are ideas and opinions that confer status on the affluent while often inflicting costs on the lower classes. A more recent example, defund the police, attitudes around addictive technology. And we can get into case-by-case examples,
right.
But that's sort of where I was coming from, very different background, very different outlook than many of my peers, a lot of graduates from elite institutions.
So the differences of luxury beliefs and just either radical beliefs or leftist beliefs, or, you know, oftentimes people from that milieu have beliefs that are characterized or caricatured by a different kind of populist politician as, you know, pie in the sky or unrealistic. It's not exactly that, though I'm sure you would assess a lot of these beliefs like defund the police as unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Luxury beliefs compared to luxury goods. And one of the ideas, and you quote some famous sociologists about this, is a purpose of a luxury good is to signal to others that you can waste your money on a luxury good. Mm-hmm. So you talk about that particular type of parka. What is it? The snow goose?
The Canada Goose jackets.
Canada Goose jackets. They do keep you warm.
They do.
But they cost $900. Mm-hmm. And you could be really just as warm for a $200 jacket. Mm-hmm. Maybe even if you shop around a $75 jacket. But the point is, what you're really doing is saying that extra, the delta, the $700, that shows you how much I have. I'm very cognizant of not just coming out and being ostentatiously wealthy, but I could show you that I could waste my wealth on such a thing. Mm-hmm. And that is why it's a luxury belief. I can waste my belief system on this idea that's somewhat preposterous, and here's another part of it, just hypocritical. And the hypocritical part is interesting to me. Tell me about the hypocrisy when you pressed people on the beliefs they espouse for others versus how they were going to live their lives.
Yeah. Well, I like that point that you made, this analogy that I draw between luxury beliefs and luxury goods. And, you know, very briefly, you know, the luxury beliefs idea grew out of ideas from Thorsten Veblen, the sociologist around the turn of the 20th century. Veblen, in his day, described the upper class in 1899 when he wrote this book, The Theory of the Leisure Class. The affluent of his day would exhibit their wealth through, you know, extravagant clothing and tuxedos and evening gowns and top hats and pocket watches and monocles and attending expensive events, hiring servants, just sort of, you know, one example I give is if you walked around New York City 100 years ago, through observation alone, it would be very clear who was rich and who was poor, just through the way they were dressed and the way they carried themselves. Whereas today in 2024, it's less true. Material goods are a noisier indicator of one's position in society. You can't always tell now just by looking at someone and sizing them up how much money they have in their bank account. And so then in the mid 20th century, there was another sociologist, Pierre Bourdieu, writing about social class. And he echoed some of Veblen's ideas, but he coined this idea of cultural capital, that the wealthy will convert their economic capital, their financial means, into exhibitions of class. But he was describing things like intricate and expensive hobbies and tastes, developing arcane knowledge around wine and art and furniture and these kinds of like niche areas, academia, getting certain kinds of degrees, and all of this sort of investing in your own social class and your own cultural capital. And my claim is that luxury beliefs are the sort of modern example, the modern incarnation of cultural capital, that people will spend extravagant sums of money to go to an elite university, or then to go on to attain high-paying white-collar jobs, the kind of jobs where they can scroll social media or Twitter X or listen to podcasts and consume the right kinds of legacy media, afford a subscription to The New Yorker and The Atlantic and all of these prestige media outlets and consume these ideas. And the hypocrisy element that you mentioned, I mean, that's interesting to me. I mean, this kind of, you know, elite level duplicity took about a year and a half on campus for me to fully grasp what was occurring here, where I'll give an example. I spoke with one of my Yale classmates, and she insisted that marriage was outdated and that monogamy and marriage and this kind of relationship arrangement was this patriarchal structure that society needed to evolve beyond. And it really is quite silly that we still cling on to this age-old institution. And then I asked her, because I was thinking about my own family. I grew up in foster homes. My family was in shambles. I thought about my friends that I grew up with in Red Bluff, California, and their families weren't any better, really. And I asked her how she grew up, and she said, "Oh, I was raised, you know, by my mom and my dad, and you know, she grew up in a, you know, very fortunate situation." I asked her, you know, once your career is, you know, picked up, and what do you want to do later on? Do you want to have a family, or what are your plans in your future? And she said, "Look, you know, I was raised that way. I'll probably do the same thing. I'll probably get a husband and raise my kids that way." But her official public position is, you shouldn't do this. Right. You know, this is kind of, you know, it's sort of, to me, analogous to like a medicine, where I'm going to tell you, yes, my parents gave me this medicine that made me healthy, and I'm going to give the medicine to my kids to make them healthy. On average, it makes people healthier, with some exceptions. Sometimes the medicine can go wrong, but on average, statistically, it does improve outcomes. But you shouldn't take this. This medicine, it's kind of patriarchal. Mm-hmm. It's kind of outdated. You shouldn't really be considering this.
What are some luxury beliefs that, since you coined the phrase, wouldn't have been called luxury beliefs, but were seen as quite radical and are now quite mainstream? And of those beliefs, I wanted to just think about the very progressive ones. And I thought of gay marriage and marijuana legalization. Okay. And to me, gay marriage wasn't really a luxury belief. I mean, it's not hurting the poor or lower classes in any way, I don't think. And then the pot legalization, there's a little more question about how that's going. But I also don't know if it's necessarily a luxury belief. And I also think that the people who held it didn't have personal hypocrisy. Like if you asked, you know, some guy in a Yale dorm room who was sucking on a bong in 1987, should this be legal? And he said, yeah, he really meant it should be legal for everyone. Yeah. So it's not necessarily the case that the beliefs that start off in academia or with the elite and don't have mainstream support, even if they're enacted and even if they're progressive, they aren't necessarily the luxury beliefs, right?
Yeah. I mean, those are two very good examples, I think, because one of them, I think, is, at least in my view, perfectly uncontroversial. I write at length in the book about how, you know, basically the most stable and best part of my upbringing was when I was raised by two gay women. And at that point this was the early and mid 2000s, gay marriage was still not legal in California. And so, you know, they were a couple, they weren't married, but they were committed to one another, and they created a good home for my adoptive sister and me. And so for that, I can't imagine anyone creating a serious argument about how that would inflict costs on, you know, poor marginalized people in any way. The marijuana one, that one. So I agree that people who championed that movement, a lot of them were college students. Probably they themselves were partaking in it. But then I don't know if there's not necessarily a duplicity there. But if if a wealthy person were to become addicted or to become hooked on marijuana such that it was, you know, to some extent detrimentally affecting their life, it still wouldn't have the same outsized costs on themselves as it would on someone who's sort of barely hanging on to a minimum wage job. And if they're high and oversleep for work or something like that, like it could be catastrophic for them. But marijuana is a tricky one, right? Because the drug itself, it's, you know, 1987, weed wasn't that powerful relative to today.
Right.
The drug is changing. I do cite an example in the book of harder drugs where, you know, where I grew up in Northern California, meth was pervasive. And on campus, people would take Adderall, which is a version of meth. But, you know, the comparison that I use is with cocaine, where if you're an 18-year-old kid on your way to Yale, you can snort some cocaine on the weekends, and in all likelihood, you'll be just fine. I mean, even if you do end up in treatment or you require some help with it, I mean, you know, your parents and your family, you can afford doctors and therapists and rehab and all of those kinds of things. Whereas if you're a kid in Red Bluff or some other poor town or city in America, you know, you take that first hit of meth and that could be well on your way to self-destruction, and you're not going to have all of those safety nets in place for you to receive care and to receive treatment to get your life back on track, to get those second chances.
Yeah.
So I think for harder drugs, it's probably a luxury belief to just, you know, indiscriminately legalize everything. Marijuana, I think it's more of a question mark. You know, 1987 weed versus 2024 weed. You know, one of those is harder than the others.
Yeah, the luxury belief version is proposed by Columbia professor Carl Hart, who has an endowed chair, and he says he does heroin recreationally all the time. And he wrote a book called Drug Use for Grownups, arguing that every kind of drug should be legal and it's safe and it's all right. And of course, where does this idea get picked up? I don't think it gains much purchase in, say, the public library of Red Bluff. I don't think people are reading that book. But I read about it in The Atlantic, and it was reviewed in the New York Times Review of Books and the podcast that The Atlantic used to do at WNYC, The Experiment, Doing Drugs as a Human Right. To me, that's classic luxury belief.
Yeah. I mean, heroin of all things. I just can't believe anyone would seriously say that, like, you know, they're just, you know, they're grownups, let them do what they want. And the thing is, like, it's one thing if, okay, you're, you know, to some extent, I could almost imagine the argument, you know, I'm enough of a libertarian that, you know, if someone is a fully grown adult, they're not hurting anyone, they're just kind of chilling out in their apartment and want to do some heroin, like, I don't know if we should legalize it, but, you know, leave the guy alone if they're not, whatever, hurting anyone else. But in many cases, this affects children, this affects family members, this affects people who depend on you. And, you know, I write at length in the early chapters of my book, my mother was addicted to drugs. That's how I ended up in the system. A lot of my foster siblings, the usual path to foster care, it's usually not outright abuse. It's usually neglect. And the neglect is the result of heavy drug use or mental illness. But the mental illness is often triggered by heavy, hardcore drug use. And so, you know, I think it's one thing if you're a Columbia professor, if you're single, if you don't have a lot of responsibilities other than your job, and if you're tenured and you're not going to get fired anyway, yeah, you know, do your thing. But to promote this view and to say that every American should have this right, regardless of their circumstances, I think is actually pretty irresponsible and does count as a luxury belief.
Yeah. And if you could cultivate the poppies from a non-Taliban controlled field somehow, I'd add that to the mix.
Yeah.
Okay. How about this? There is an idea, and I subscribe to this, that if you look at polling on the question like the environment, the only people who vote on the environment are people in the top 5%, typically 5% of income. And it might be a luxury belief, but, you know, if we look at the luxury classes,
yeah,
the aristocracy, they created very worthy things, right? Art,
yeah,
and ideas and the Enlightenment. So might there be some ideas, such as the environment, that have to come from the people with a place of elitism or just, you know, not working a double shift and taking up all their mental bandwidth to contemplate?
So on the climate example itself, I mean, yes, like a good idea can arise, but it can take, again, like, not just because some of their ideas are good doesn't mean all of them are, right? This is why I define luxury beliefs in this kind of narrow way. So a good example of this is a noble idea that came from affluent, educated people was the abolitionist movement, reversing slavery, turning us over, and aiming toward an ideal of colorblindness. But I think there was this interesting kind of trickle-down fashion effect that I describe in the book, such that initially sort of the masses of Americans were either in support or indifferent to slavery. And it was this upper segment of society, members of it, not all of it, but members of that upper segment that were championing abolitionist movements, moving towards a colorblind society. And as a result of their outsized influence and ability to control discourse, and because that was the kind of high status fashionable opinion that eventually overtook society, such that I would say that most Americans today, even if they don't necessarily, their behavior doesn't always live up to it, I would say most Americans have the ideal that people should be treated on their merits, take people as they are, treat people as individuals, not as members of racial categories. And my claim, and this is speculative, is that in response to this, a lot of members of the elite see this and think, how can I stand out from the masses once again? Now that colorblindness is the ideal adopted by everyone, I'm going to go back and re-racialize society and say, oh, wait, actually, race does matter, and you shouldn't culturally appropriate, and we should be very aware of how we treat other people based on their ethnicity. And we should, there are a lot of reports now coming out of various elite universities where they're now segregating dorms by race, but out of some kind of misguided notion of enlightened views about how, oh, you know, they feel threatened when they're around white students, or the white students don't want to be around this group or that group or the other. And so they're now sort of reigniting racialized feeling. And I think that's a real mistake, actually.
We're listening to my interview with Rob Henderson, whose new book is called Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class. It's a great conversation. It went on for almost 20 minutes more. I'm not going to burden/bless you with all of that intellectual exchange. It'll be opt-in if you're a subscriber to Pesca Plus. You've heard me talk about it. If you subscribe to Pesca Plus, you get at least one conversation like this a week of extra content. We'll take away the ads. If you just say, you know what, none of the plus, I could really use an ad-free experience. We offer that too for only like $5 a month. The prices have not risen with inflation. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to join the elite.
The NBA playoffs are back. And on FanDuel, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. Back in the day, news like this, your crew would have been writing each other letters.
Dearest Benjamin, wonderful news from the East. The spread has been covered.
Or maybe you'd use your phone to actually call someone.
Man, you see that dunk? Man, I saw that dunk.
But these days, it's all about the group chat.
I love that high-fiving kitten emoji.
No matter how you tell them, let your crew know that all new FanDuel customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. Ooh, Morse code. Classic. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's HARBINGER, like the first three letters in hard,
BINGE, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. To hear members of the movement tell it, they are the most impassioned, moral, convicted, resolute people in the Democratic Party. And what form does that expression take? What do we call them? We call them the uncommitted.
What we saw in Michigan, where over 100,000 Democrats went to the polls and voted non-committed. Obviously a protest vote to the president's handling of the situation in Gaza. How concerned, as a political matter, should Democrats be?
I don't think we should be concerned about this as a political matter, because this is such a critical issue relative to America's national security and the security of the Middle East. I would hope that the president doesn't make decisions about what to do in Gaza or the Middle East based upon how the votes line up. Listen, I think it is time for the president to use all the leverage that he has to get a long-term ceasefire. I think if that ceasefire doesn't come, it's in Israel's interest for them to pause military activity to solve the humanitarian crisis. But to the extent the president is using additional leverage on Israel, he should do that for national security reasons, not for political reasons. These issues are too important to be dictated by the polls.
ABC's Jonathan Carl there speaking to Senator Chris Murphy after the Michigan primary. And as you know, with 100,000 votes in Michigan, I have said that the uncommitted movement is significant, significant enough to potentially pose a problem for President Biden in that state, the state of Michigan. But what about the result of yesterday's primaries, Tuesday's primaries? Some call them Super Tuesday, not based on yesterday, however. Well, uncommitted got enough votes to earn delegates in a few states. How many? Joseph R. Biden Jr., the incumbent, according to the AP, as of this recording, has netted 1,513 delegates, and uncommitted weighs in with 13. Again, that's 1,513 to 13. And by the way, those 13 delegates are literally uncommitted. They don't have to vote for Biden, but if they want to, they can vote for Biden. Literally, their state party officials will send them to the convention, and they will cast their potentially symbolic votes for anyone they want, including Joe Biden. So they could go at Rashida Tlaib or Tulsi Gabbard, definitely not Yasser Arafat. He's ineligible. Minnesota did contribute the bulk of those uncommitted delegates to the convention. I hope they still get the good lanyards once they show up. I hope they're all invited to the best pro-Biden hospitality suites. I'd hate to see them shunned. The state of Minnesota went 19% uncommitted. That is 46,000 votes. Will all 46,000 of those votes be withholding their support for Biden come November? Well, that's what Minnesota's Council on American Islamic Relations Executive Director, Dr. Jelani Hussein, would have you believe.
Not only that, it could actually motivate and influence U.S. policy if you really think about it. Jesse, I do have to ask you something, though. In Michigan, that movement, they only had a few weeks to really get together. They had about $200,000 to be organized and to spend. In Minnesota, did this build out of what they saw in Michigan, or were they organizing for more weeks? You know, we've had so much of war lately, and we've been covering the war so much since it started. Were they more organized in Michigan, or do you feel less organized?
It seems like this is a similar kind of pseudo last-minute grassroots effort, Tom. Not a lot of funding, not any big advertising. In fact, one of the people who said she was voting uncommitted said that she heard about it on the national news, Tom.
I don't think his numbers get there. For one thing, there are a lot of reasons why a person might vote uncommitted. The effort to turn an uncommitted vote into a protest vote over Gaza policy. I mean, that was the one emphasized by the media and by the organizers of that effort, but it didn't always land in the minds of the voters. I say that because I have seen and read clips of Minnesota voters saying they chose uncommitted just because they don't like both of their choices, because Joe Biden was too liberal, right? We used to have more conservative Democrats. That's what I'd like. And many of the very groups who sought to brand the uncommitted vote as equaling ceasefire tried to burnish their own status as upstart underdogs by emphasizing just how ragtag and last minute their efforts were, how little money they had to organize. And still they said, we got 40,000 votes. Okay. Maybe that's an indication that your branding efforts worked, but maybe it's also an indication that the 40,000 votes didn't have a lot to do with a ceasefire in Gaza, or didn't have
everything to do with a ceasefire in Gaza. People in Minnesota who voted uncommitted were literally uncommitted. They weren't necessarily anti-Israel. What's the evidence? Let's think of some evidence rather than my just floating the idea out there. Let's look at some other states where we have good data. So in many of the rundowns of the popularity of uncommitted or no preference, that was a choice in some states, you see North Carolina cited. This is from the New York Times write-up. In North Carolina, 12% of voters had cast ballots for no preference. In Massachusetts, no preference had earned 9%. That was with 80% of the vote in, as the Times was writing that. Okay. So North Carolina, 12% no preference. Massachusetts, 9% no preference instead of voting for Joe Biden. Let's go back to 2012. Then Barack Obama was in the same position as Joe Biden. He was the Democratic president and incumbent running without real opposition. And in that year, it wasn't 9% of Massachusetts who voted no preference. It was 10% who voted no preference against him or not for him in Massachusetts. In North Carolina, 12% of voters voted no preference this year. Well, 21% of voters in the Democratic primary of 2012 voted no preference. In 2012, here was a Wall Street Journal commentator referencing the results of the Kentucky primary.
Obama had a pretty bad showing himself in the Democratic primaries in Kentucky and Arkansas. He had tough competition in Kentucky from a guy named Uncommitted.
42% of Democratic primary voters went uncommitted. Barack Obama getting 58%. Let's see if uncommitted gets half of that 42% number when the Democratic primary is held there in May. If so, let's see if that result is held out as a pro-Palestinian statement. The supposedly impressive Michigan uncommitted as proxy for Gaza vote also only showed a 2% uptick over 2012. Unfortunately, you can't judge the results of the Minnesota 2024 vote to 2012 because in 2012 they had a caucus system, not a primary. We can go to Michigan, the supposedly impressive Michigan uncommitted vote, uncommitted as a proxy for Gaza policy, that only showed a 2% uptick over 2012. So to be very clear, I absolutely think there is a small, maybe slightly larger than small, very vocal faction of the Democratic caucus that's so turned off by Biden's Israel policies, they won't vote for him or somehow will vote for Trump. I don't know about that one. I'm not saying anything other than, yes, Michigan's at risk, you know, got to campaign hard. All states, especially states where you won by 150,000 votes last time, that's at risk. Michigan has a very large Muslim population. I'm talking about Michigan. When we move to Minnesota, I actually don't think Minnesota is at risk because of the Gaza issue. Biden won in 2020 by 230,000 votes. The Arab population is a tenth of Michigan's. The Muslim population is less than half of Michigan's. Take as a data point the fact that Ilhan Omar, after cruising to Democratic nominations in past years, just eked out a 2% victory in her Minnesota district in 2022. Wait, what's that mean in terms of Biden's vulnerability over the issue of Israel? It just says that Minnesota isn't close to being the pro-Palestinian place Michigan is. And by the way, Rashida Tlaib, prominent Muslim squad member from Michigan, she is Palestinian. Ilhan Omar is not. Another important point, and one I've made before, is that for Joe Biden to reverse his policies, it wouldn't just have benefits in wooing these anti-Israeli voters. It would also have costs in turning off pro-Israeli voters. There is a sizable Jewish community in Minnesota. Do you know what U.S. state has been represented by the most Jewish senators in the U.S. Senate? It would be pretty weird if the answer were Arkansas for a few reasons, mostly rhetorically, but also demographically. But my point is, no, it's Minnesota. Al Franken was one. Let me try the rest. Norm Coleman, Rudy Boschwitz, and who was the fourth Minnesota Jewish senator? Oh, yes, he was Paul Wellstone. Don't you like how I do that in real time? Fascinating for you. I hope you were yelling, "It's Paul Wellstone." Here's the important point about Joe Biden if he were to change policies. He knows everything I said, or at least the people close to him, but I also think he knows everything I said. He might get some of the words wrong, but he knows it. He knows that the images and the realities of dead children and civilians in Gaza hurts him. He knows that a raging war, well, two raging wars, but one at full U.S. funding, is bad for his business. So he's been jawboning Israeli leaders. He's been signaling his distance from Netanyahu, which is real. He does not like the guy, vice versa. Actually, both of their political fortunes are pretty much dependent on not liking the other one. He has authorized Kamala Harris to loudly advocate for ceasefire, even if not in the absolute terms. You may have gotten the impression that she's been speaking in. She actually didn't articulate a change in the administration's policy. She just banged the lectern in different places. But that is all part of my point. Of all the known risks of the presidential campaign, Israel policy is perhaps, I'm not going to say the least risky, it's just the most attended to. They are paying attention, which doesn't mean, by the way, that they're definitely backing off their policy. It doesn't mean that they're going the other way. It just means they know that this is a risk, and I think they're properly contextualizing their risk. And let's also remember that the future is unknowable, which means that the very status of the very war said to make Joe Biden vulnerable in November, that might be very different. It might be better than it is now. It just might be much less of a salient issue, either because things calm down or because the human capacity to not pay attention or habituate yourself to any circumstance is what it is. So while I think Joe Biden may lose to Donald Trump, I really, really don't think Joe Biden will lose because of his Israel policy. And on that, you can count me firmly committed. That's it for today's show. Corey Wara is The Gist's producer. Joel Patterson, The Gist's senior producer. Quaint Mallards, though they are. Michelle Pesca is in charge of quality control and other special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomperoo-jee-peroo-doo-peroo. I want to thank you for listening. Just for some reason, I like the cut of Kyrsten Sinema's jib. With this, sorry.